You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina.
Well, buongiorno and benvenuti to the cycling podcast Femina. Now, I'm sure most listeners to this podcast have probably been very fixated on what's going on in France, but here on the Cycling Podcast Feminine, we're going to drag you back over the Alps into Italy to talk about the Giro d'Italia women. And if you like your races decided by tiny, like literally the smallest margin you could think of, literally 1 second in places, then this is the race that you're going to like more than that Tour de France rubbish for sure. And discussing that with me, well, I've got my two lovely co-hosts. Between them, they have 2 Olympic golds, 5 world championship titles, and an under-9s player of the tournament for the Roffey Robins, at the Roffey Robins. I'll let the listeners decide who they think which accolade belongs to. But joining me, Denny Gray.
Lovely to have you, Denny.
Hello. In a lovely yellow, well, it's actually more Tour, getting into Tour de France spirit, a yellow, lovely mustard shirt. Yellow shoes.
Obviously, getting ready for the Tour de France fam, and nothing to do with what else is going on in France at the moment.
You wouldn't know anything about that at all. And Joe Rousel, ex-pro, and, you know, to be honest, not a player of the tournament for the Roffey Robins.
No, I haven't got that one, unfortunately.
No, I'm sorry about that. I know you're probably sitting there thinking, why did she mention that? Yeah. The one thing that's almost heartbreaking to even mention. But Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. First time on the podcast.
Yes. Yeah, so obviously a keen listener, but yeah, very keen to discuss all the goings on in women's cycling in the last month.
And I should say another, you don't have to live in the borough of Wandsworth, the London borough of Wandsworth, but it does help another Wandsworth local, because we are continuing the Tour de Wandsworth, and this was your suggestion, Joe, the leather bottle.
Yeah, leather bottle, possibly the best beer garden in London. That's a big statement, but I mean, at the moment we're pretty empty in here, but you do get a good atmosphere in here when yeah, but not on a sort of afternoon. one of my locals, so nice.
No, it's
here.
Lovely, and it's been redone recently, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I believe so. I've been desperate to come here, but it's very, very peaceful. Well, I say that just as a plane comes over, and just after Denny's kindly asked the staff to not do the glass recycling right now, so it has become a really peaceful, beautiful place. Well, we're going to talk about the Giro d'Italia women, as I mentioned, but also got the mini feature this month, and that's all based around almost kind of like a, not a corrections corner, because we didn't know at the time, but when we recorded our last episode, we didn't realise that literally, was it that afternoon, Denny?
Yeah.
Or was it the next day?
Literally hours after
Anna van der Breggen would announce that she was going to return to the peloton the next day. So we kind of doing all this speculation about transfers and what are SD Works really going to do next year? And of course, Anna van der Breggen hours later said she was coming back. So to remedy that, my feature is on comebacks. We'll hear from Anna van der Breggen, from her what they call press moment, which I think might be a mistranslation somewhere, about her reasons for coming back. And also from someone who's actually recently done it, Ruth Edwards, whose maiden name was Ruth Winder, who everyone might know her better as, who's come back and really having a storming season, having retired actually in the same year as Anna van der Breggen did. But anyway, that's all to come. Let's first talk about the Giro d'Italia women, shall we? Now, Joe, we heard your lovely voice on the comm, so I know you were definitely watching.
Yeah.
What did you take from the race overall? It was a real exciting, thrilling one, wasn't it?
Yeah, thrilling from start to finish. After the first time chart, Elisa Longo Borghini had a 1 second lead on GC, very closely matched by Grace Brown in that opening time chart. Very technical time chart as well, and some wet conditions. And then throughout the race, she was never really safe, never really had a good buffer. And going into the last stage, it was just 1 second. It was over Lotta Kopecky then, going to the final stage. And I just think throughout the week she had that pink jersey on every single day. It clearly meant so much to her, really emotional moments, being Italian, but it was never safe. It was never a foregone conclusion. She never had that buffer. And right onto that last stage, we were like, I don't know if she's going to get this. And I'm also a massive Lotta Kopecky fan. I'm a massive fan of both riders. And it really could have gone either way in that final stage. So really exciting Giro, start to finish, did not disappoint at all.
It was it was just crazy, wasn't it, really? And I was same as you, Joe. I actually didn't think that Elise coming into that last stage was going to take the pink jersey at all, because Lotta Kopecky, she's so strong at sprinting. So it was kind of even more remarkable that Lisa Longo-Borghini got it. And also, I think it kind of, you know, she was very emotional about it, obviously, as you said, Joe, because of being Italian. But I think it meant even more at the finish line to have won it when she probably even didn't quite believe that she could necessarily do it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge achievement for her, really. Probably, I mean, I know she's had many great wins over her career and many great wins this year. She won Flanders earlier this year. But this feels like her, maybe not a breakthrough win, but maybe the biggest win of her career to win a Grand Tour. The first Italian to win the Giro since 2008. It was a huge, huge achievement. And as you said, it wasn't a foregone conclusion. I think this was probably by far and away the best stage race we've seen this year. The fact that it was suspenseful all the way through, we haven't seen anything like that this year so far. Joe, you were saying off air, of course, we've seen kind of very different stage racing in Spain, so where Demi Vollering has been so dominant. So this was really refreshing to see such a close race, and also such different stages as well. I think there was such huge variety. I really enjoyed the fact that we got a couple of sprint finishes, but we also had some breakthrough wins, some riders that we've been talking about this year, like Kim LeCourt, getting their big moments for the first time.
And people you've tried not to talk about, which is like Neve Bradbury. I think actually Kim LeCourt you've tried to avoid talking about once or twice before. But all of these riders that I've always given you the opportunity, Denny, to, you know, put your money, you know, and say down on these riders and say these riders are going to do well, and you always try and skirt out of it. But now they're showing you up, aren't they?
Well, no, I like to think it's like reverse psychology, some kind of, I don't know, weird
whispering going on.
Yeah, anyway.
Trying to get your attention, perhaps. But, yeah, well, I mean, we have kind of touched on the fact that Demi Vollering wasn't there because, you know, the fact that the Spanish racing were all so dominated by her, and indeed stage racing has been dominated by SD Works, hasn't it? Elise Longo-Borghini was Orla's pick, wasn't she? Orla did say last episode that she thought Elise Longo-Borghini would do it, but I think it meant a huge amount to actually do it, because she's done the Giro 12 times, and I think on her first one, let me have a look, I'm looking at my notes now, I don't know this off by heart, she finished 18th, and then since then, you know, in more recent times, she's finished 4th, she's finished 3rd behind Anna van der Breggen and Katja Nieuwendom in 2020. In 2017, she lost out to Anna van der Breggen, but not having Demi Vollering there, not that we should talk about a rider who wasn't actually at the race too much, but it did kind of clear the path, didn't it, Joe, for Elise Longo-Borghini to kind of show what she was made of?
Yeah, the start list in general, like looking at it before the race, I was like, this is a wide open race. And Elise Longo-Borghini had been named by a number of people as a favourite, but it was never a case of, well, she's clearly the best climber. We had a stage with 3,700 metres of climbing, and other riders, like you said, that weren't there, you'd think, right, okay, they're going to ride away on that stage, take 5 minutes, and you know, that'll be race over. But there was nobody on the start list where you're like, they are head and shoulders above the rest of the world at climbing. We had some really, really good talent in there. Neve Bradbury, as you've mentioned. Lotta Kopecky, we've got to add climbing to her, you know, high mountains as her list of things that she can do now, because we can't
what
keep
isn't
avoiding
on the
that
list?
One. Exactly. Yeah, we've got flat, we've got cobbles, we've got everything in between. So yeah, going into it, we knew it was going to be more open than previous stage races. But I'm also really impressed with the way the course was designed, or the route was designed, that we had the Queen stage on stage 7 of 8. Huge amount of climbing, up Blockhouse twice. Brutal day out of massive high temperatures as well, but then still we had a first category climb on the final day, which meant you had a very much reduced peloton. Kopecky didn't have the teamwork, like teammates around her to help her out perhaps, and just the way they designed the route, it was just perfect to go into that final stage with 1 second. It was everything we could have possibly wanted. The talent was sort of quite evenly spread among the teams as well. It wasn't one super team. Little Trek were of course really strong, but there was sort of talent spread out. So yeah, no, it was brilliant.
And what did you think there, Denny, on that final stage? We touched upon it, but you know, 1 second advantage. I thought that maybe Little Trek were being maybe a little bit risky towards the end. I feel like I'm always bashing Little Trek on this podcast, but I promise I'm not. I really like Little Trek and I wanted them to do well. But I thought it was very risky coming into those last few stages with the fact that Lotta Kopecky had basically been taking time out of Elisa Longo Borghini on a lot of stages, mainly because of the fact that she got in total kind of 28 seconds in bonus seconds from finishing on the podium on a lot of stages and getting that win as well. So that she'd been constantly carving away at this loss that had happened on that first stage in the time trial. So I thought it was kind of very risky for Little Trek to be going into those last few stages and not be maybe as offensive as they could be. Maybe more, they went for the sort of, I'm just going to follow Lotta Kopecky's wheel and hope to get around her at the end, or hope to come across the line at the same time. So what was your view on that, Denny?
Yeah, I mean, I know where you're coming from. And
well, that's a relief.
I'm not going to lay into you all her style.
Thank goodness.
But what I would say is that, I mean, I guess at the end of the day they won the race. So in that
it's
sense,
all's well that ends well,
paid
isn't
off.
It? A bit,
I think, but I think arguably, I think actually on the final stage, I think Lidl Trek played it really well, because Lotta Kopecky's game plan, she said before the stage, was getting the bonus seconds. And that meant that SD Works had to control the race for the entire stage. And they found it enormously difficult. Even Kopecky,
which is surprising, because they're so used to doing that.
Yeah,
and they've always been so used to kind of
almost
bullying the other riders into doing what they want them to do.
That's right. But it wasn't probably a full-strength SD Works team. And, of course, Marlon Reuser pulled out beforehand. So she was very sorely missed, I think, on that kind of stage. But it meant they had to do a lot of work on that final stage. Kopecky was chasing some of the breaks and some of the moves, using up her own energy to try to keep the race together in the hope that she might get those bonus seconds. So I guess another way of looking at it is arguably, did SD Works play it right in the final stage? Could Kopecky have looked at attacking and maybe, you know, losing Longo Borghini rather than solely relying on the bonus seconds? I feel like maybe where they were more risky was on stage 7, where
that's the big blockhouse.
The blockhouse stage where it felt like Lidl Trek used up a lot of their riders early on, and Guy Raylini was used just to kind of pace Longo Borghini
for a long time.
Whereas actually, as you kind of alluded to earlier, Joe, that was the kind of stage where you could have put minutes into your rivals potentially, and a Guy Raylini attack maybe might have unnerved SD Works. You know, how would Kopecky have reacted to that, knowing that somebody like Guy Raylini, who's such a good climber, could have put minutes into her? So I don't know. I don't know if it's as straightforward as Lidl Trek kind of getting it wrong, because it was such a complex...
Did I say that?
I don't know, did you? Just rewind the tape.
I'm not sure. The listeners will know better than I will now.
Yeah, anyway, so I don't know. I mean, at SD Works, I'm not sure anyone played it perfectly, but it was a very complicated race to marshal. And as you said, Joe, it was so open. There wasn't one team dominating, and that's what made it so enjoyable to watch.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by MAP.
Well, let's talk a bit about the blockhouse stage, because I thought that actually, you know, like you mentioned there, Denny, that the riders were sort of a little bit cagey on that stage, and obviously you are going to be cagey when it's so much climbing that you're not going to really kind of go full beans at it, are you, without knowing what's going to happen later on. But I did feel like they kind of did all stay together for quite a long time in a way that we haven't really seen too much recently, and maybe that's because of the kind of the Vollering effect, where she kind of goes herself and blows the whole thing up. But I did think that they approached that climb in quite a cagey manner. Would that have been that kind of, for me, felt like that played into Kopecky's hands a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, similar to what you've just said as well, I think you could have played the card of having Guy Raylini there to go on the attack and sort of force force Nefisher Black perhaps to be the one chasing it back. But I felt like we came on air when they were on the first ascent of Blockhouse towards the top. And initially I was like, we've missed most of the climb. But actually, I don't think much really happened that first time. Like, there would have been action at the back of the peloton with riders getting dropped. But I think going into a stage like that with that many metres of climbing, 3,700, which is uncharted territory on race day for most of the riders in this peloton. I think if you go back far enough in history, you'll have found stages that have got similar amounts of climbing. But for this current crop of riders, pretty much uncharted territory. There's probably going to be an exception now that somebody lets me know about. But in the most part, we don't see that much climbing in one stage, plus the heat. Like, I think if I were riding, I would have been in survival mode first time up, and then second time up, survive as long as I can, and then see what happens. You also got altitude coming into play as well. But yeah, for Little Trek, Elisa Longo-Borghini found herself in the position where Niamh Bradbury was up the road, and at this point wasn't challenging for the pink jersey, but she couldn't completely like sit up, because if she had, that pink jersey could have gone, and Niamh Bradbury was going absolutely full gash, taking out so much time. So it was a difficult situation, because Gaia Relini had gone by that point, and it's so easy sat here with the power of hindsight to say, oh, this is what I would have done or wouldn't have done. I don't know if they particularly got stage 7 right. I think they got stage 8 really right, Legal Trek. I think SD Works didn't get stage 8 right at all. But looking at the parkours for that day, we had a first category climb in the middle of the stage, and that really thinned out the bunch to the point where you just had Niamh Fisher-Black and Lotta Kopecky going to the second half of that stage. And poor Niamh Fisher-Black was the rider on the front on pretty much a flat, straight road, trying to keep that breakaway under control. And you thought, of all the riders in the peloton to be given that job, you know, she's a superb climber, but this is not her forte. And that was the only rider Kopecky had left by that point. So I don't know whether too many matches have been burnt early on or just throughout the week, but they just didn't have the firepower or the sort of the manpower of the team at that point to control it anymore.
And there were going to be so many riders trying to get away on that final stage, weren't there? Because you know, that the GC competition had been so down to Lotta Kopecky and Elisa Longo-Borghini for so long, and it felt actually a little bit like we had no idea, I think, when we were previewing this last month, that first stage, which is like a 14-kilometre time trial, would be so instrumental in laying out what was going to happen for the rest of the race. Obviously, that's down to the fact that Elisa Longo-Borghini performed so well there. But it was kind of crazy to have that as a starting point. And I think almost it felt like the race was split into two, even at that stage, where it became, I think Juliette Labousse was basically the only other GC contender under 30 seconds, within 30 seconds of Elisa Longo-Borghini at that stage. So it felt to me a little bit like the race was separated into two at that point. And then we were kind of following through the rest of the week, this Longo-Borghini versus Kopecky, and this kind of everyone else. I don't know if you felt the same there, Denny, but it was surprising that time trial was so
I did and
big
I
effect.
Didn't, because Longo-Borghini and Kopecky were clearly the strongest riders up until that point. And as you say, she had a brilliant time trial, didn't she? And she had 20-odd seconds over Kopecky there, but then Kopecky was slowly eating away at that lead. And you felt the momentum was in her favour, but that Blockhouse stage was so daunting and so out of the blue, as you said, Joe, that I felt that the race could have gone completely differently. We weren't really sure how anybody was going to be able to perform on that stage, because it was the unknown. And I know that Kopecky did well on that Tourmalet stage in the Tour when she discovered her climbing legs. But we weren't really clear whether she could repeat that, especially at the end of a tough Giro with the heat. And she's said afterwards she's using this as preparation for the Olympics, you know, where she's going to be riding on the track. So, you know, she wasn't perhaps in the same shape or the same position she was at the Tour Femme last year. So I felt like it was a big unknown. And Longo-Borghini is not an out-and-out climber as Niamh Bradbury or somebody else was. So I felt like there was the potential for somebody like a Niamh Bradbury or somebody else to create some distance and some time. So it wasn't, and I think that was one of the things I loved about the race, even though it was all about Kopecky and Longo-Borghini for six stages in the GC race. Stage 7 could have turned things on its head.
Well, we should give a bit more kudos actually to Lotta Kopecky's performance, because, you know, we did see her, like you said, on the Tourmalet at the Tour de France Femme last year, a phenomenal performance. And I was actually just looking back over her result performance at the Tour de France Femme. She had, out of the eight stages, five podiums in those eight stages, plus a fourth and a 14th place and sixth place on that Tourmalet stage. It's just absolutely outrageous. I think at the time you kind of don't notice there's so much going on at the Tour and so many kind of little battles going on that you don't notice how absolutely incredible that is. And the fact that she's kind of backed it up now again at the Giro, it's just astounding. But Joe, as someone yourself who's, you know, been a track champion and, you know, ridden road as well, are we thinking that actually Lotte Kopecky, if she wanted to turn herself to being a GC rider, she could be even more powerful, even more strong than she already is?
Potentially, yeah. It's a very difficult question to answer because I feel that the way that the peloton are riding now in the World Tour is very different to when I was racing. Like, the level has moved on miles and miles and miles. You know, it's light years away from the days when I was racing. But also the type of stages we're getting now. Like, back in my day, I was racing alongside people like Emma Pooley, who was a fantastic climber, but there were very few opportunities for her to really showcase that talent because we very rarely had these proper big high mountains in our stage races. Probably good for people like me. Not so good for Emma Pooley, who would have loved to have ridden away on all those climbs. Of course, she did have a few opportunities, but now, you know, it's shifted to, we have got, you know, so many more of these high mountains. But Lotte is just amazingly consistent across so many different areas. And you know, we're seeing that in the men's side of the sport as well. You know, we're seeing people like Tadej Pogačar, Remco Evenepoel doing, you know, brilliant things across different types of bike races. I don't know if it... I think the two complement each other. I think the way track racing is changing, riders are riding bigger and bigger gears. It's less about that pure leg speed. It's more about power. And I think that can really complement on the road as well. And of course, all the sort of cobble classics type races, definitely, you know, that's a real advantage. I don't know whether there's much she can really change about herself to get even better at these high mountains, but she's already right up there. Like, we don't really think of her as the climber, but she is already so close. It probably wouldn't take much of a difference, maybe less in terms of physique, more in terms of perhaps time at altitude, those sort of things that you could do, the sort of different ways you can plan your training. And a lot of that is also around where you've got your other competitions, what races you're targeting. And she said herself she was using the Giro as training for the Olympics, where she's got time trial first, then road race, then the track. So yeah, I guess if you were training for the Giro, you'd probably adjust your season slightly. You might have an altitude camp at a different point. But yeah, she was saying she's using this for the Olympics, where she's got road and track. Definitely looking towards her for the Olympic road race as well. But yeah, it's tricky juggling all these different targets. But I think it helps. You know, it gives you confidence. You know, you take a win in a track race, the European Championships in January, that gives you a good boost over your rivals. So I'm not sure if taking one out would massively improve her. I think she's good anyway.
Yeah, she's all right.
She's all right.
She's
yeah.
Good at everything. Yeah, yeah. Well, we've spoken so much about Kopecky and Longo Borghini, but Denny, there were, like you mentioned, there were quite a few breakthrough kind of rides, weren't there, in this year? Any particular people that you want to actually talk about?
Should I talk about Neve Bradbury?
Are you actually going to? Those notes are going to come out today.
No, why not? Okay. I mean, I think that was a breakthrough ride for her, and I know we've kind of I've skirted around the edges of her brilliant 2024, but you know, she's only 22 and she came third overall, and I think it was a tremendous, tremendous performance.
She was my pick, Denny, though, wasn't she? That was my choice last month for the Giro.
Okay, well.
When she got on the podium. Who did you pick, Denny?
Gaia Raiolini.
Oh.
But of course, she was on Team Duty.
No, exactly.
They didn't let her off the leash. Otherwise, it would have been a different story. but yeah, I thought that was a real coming of age win for her, and I think she'd won a stage in the Tour de Suisse kind of the month before, and I find it fascinating that she came through the Zwift Academy, and I know we talked a little bit about that earlier in the year, but it's kind of given, I guess, greater credence to that process as well, that a rider can come through that and now be a kind of stage winner in a Grand Tour. She's such a good climber, and it really excites me to see where she might go next. I mean, one chink in her armoury, and I know we shouldn't be talking about her GC potential quite yet because we should just kind of celebrate her win, but she lost over 40 seconds to Longo Borghini in that time trial. So clearly, if she does want to become a GC contender in the future, then that's something she might need to work on. But yeah, I thought that was tremendous. And of course, Kim LaCourte was another rider. We talked about the fact she's, I think the last time she rode the Giro was when she was racing last in the peloton in 2016.
Wow.
And she was DNF on stage two. So to come back into full-time racing this year and to win a stage of the Giro, it's just an incredible kind of almost kind of rags to riches type story for her, wasn't it? And although I was very confused, and I don't know how you found it in commentary, Joe, but she looked like with her Mauritian champions jersey on, I kept getting confused for Lotte Kopecky.
Yeah, it's way too similar. I did Google the Mauritian flag because I was like, surely it can't be that similar. But the world champion jersey is blue, red, black, yellow, green, and the Mauritian jersey is red, blue, yellow, green. But the blue and the black, obviously it's a dark blue, it does look quite similar. So fortunately Lotte Kopecky was in the red jersey, so she was also slightly easier to identify. But had Lotte been in the world champs jersey, I think it would have been difficult on like the aerial shots to have really pick the two apart. But yeah, I don't know whether the UCI would make any issues over that, because it is different. It's not quite the same colours, but keeping us on our toes as commentators, certainly.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, she was, well, she'd be not, I can't say that she's worthy of being world champion, but you know, she was performing fantastic. The reason that we would even get her medalled up is that she was always at the front of the race, wasn't she? And I think Kim LaCourte's one of those riders where if you look at the results, you don't, for you know, this year, you don't necessarily say they're kind of outstanding. Well, I mean, 10th in Paris-Roubaix and 9th in Depana and 4th on the GC in Catalonia, just on the top of my head, but of course. But you know, when you look at her results, you don't necessarily wouldn't necessarily say that it's kind of been a breakthrough season, but it has, because you know, she's performing way beyond, I think, expectation, and in a team that AG Insurance, which doesn't necessarily have the support that a lot of other teams are giving her. But and of course there was also a massive win, actually the first ever pro win for Clara Amond on stage four of EF Oatley Cannondale. And we've been watching EF Oatley Cannondale, as they are now EF Cannondale, all year, and kind of remarking on their phenomenal opportunistic kind of way that they get these victories, and outshining a lot of the World Tour teams. You know, they are still a continental team after all.
Yeah, I mean, another great, what more can you say about them really? Another great performance by them. They just seem to have that knack of getting those opportunities, as you say, that they are the perfect opportunists, aren't they? And time and time again they keep getting these stage victories. I think and it's great to see another rider from their roster getting a victory as well. They just seem to be, I don't know, have these riders that come to the right stage at the right time in the right kind of form and get their win. So yeah, another remarkable performance by them.
They've had four World Tour wins this year from four different riders. And something I found interesting during the Giro was when Leanna Lippert won. That was the first World Tour win this year for Movistar.
Which is crazy.
And obviously, Annemiek van Vleuten has retired, and they have had wins in other races. But that was actually, this is big that they've got their first World Tour win. Then you contrast that to EF Oatley Cannondale, and they've taken their fourth one. They had two at the Vuelta, two different riders. They had Lotte Henteler at Burgos, then here as well. So really brilliant season spread across riders and the team across the different races.
And we should give a bit more time to actually talking about Leanna Lippert, because that was phenomenal for her to get a win. Because I think when Annemiek van Vleuten left last year, it was kind of, there was a lot of pressure on her that she would become this GC rider, when in many ways that's not really her strength. That's not what she's really good at. So I think it was really refreshing to see her get a win, an exciting win, you know, a bit like the win that we saw actually at the Tour de France last year, that she got when, like, finished crossing the line with a huge smile, you know, taking the win in a really exciting stage. But it meant a lot for her to get that win there, didn't it, Joe?
Yeah, because she's returning from a stress fracture as well. It's been good that she's been given the space by the team to sort of recover and come back at her own pace. But that was also a really exciting stage, because it finished at the top of a third category climb. We had a breakaway of four riders, four really strong riders, but the peloton was closing in, and we were saying on commentary, like, how much of a gap do they need to ensure they stay away to the finish? And Marty said he reckoned they needed about 2.5 minutes, which was exactly what they had pretty much by the second going into that final climb. Ended up about 20 seconds ahead of the peloton, and it was a fantastic victory for Leanna Lippert, but such a strong breakaway. That could have gone either way. And Ruth Edwards got second there. She was also second on the final stage. So she was racing super aggressively. It looked to me like she had really good legs, and I think she might get this. But Leanna Lippert, just with the patience and timing that move to perfection at the end to get that victory.
Well, Joe set me up perfectly there to talk about Ruth Edwards in light of the fact that she retired actually in 2021, the same year as Anna van der Breggen retired. And of course, we've had that news that Anna van der Breggen is returning to the peloton. She's not going to be a director sportif any longer. And so, yes, she had a press moment, as I said at the top of the show. So let's hear from her now.
I quit now for 3 years, and I was really happy in between to have a nice job in cycling. And I see the sport every day, and slowly motivation to do it myself was coming back. I feel competition inside of me, so I always want to win. But that doesn't mean that you're always gonna win. And probably it's going to be tough to get back on the high level. And of course I'm aiming for better than it was, but that's always a question. So for me, there's not so much ticking the boxes anymore in races or in victories. It's more about enjoying the sport and the competition.
Well, it's quite clear that for van der Breggen, competitive cycling is an itch she hasn't quite been able to scratch. She hung up her wheels in 2021 with diminished motivation. Now, though, it seems her mojo is well and truly back. But will the time away bring a fresh approach? One rider she might look to who has managed to come back from retirement is Ruth Edwards, formerly Winder. The American quit in the same year as van der Breggen, only to come back this season. In this month's feature, we hear why Edwards walked away from the sport and her lessons learned as she returned to winning ways with Team Human Powered Health.
I honestly didn't feel like I had a choice when I retired. And I know that sounds silly, but I think I was just the definition of burnt out. Like, I just wasn't myself anymore. I'm not sure I was very much fun company for anybody to be around. And I just was really tired. I was so tired, and I was tired of having to get on a plane all the time to fly to Europe. I was tired of missing my husband and my friends. And yeah, I was tired of having to sleep in a different bed all the time. And for me, I've never really picked one spot in Europe to say, okay, this is where I live when I'm gone from home. But that makes all of those things kind of pile up and the fatigue add up. And racing is also just so hard. And I remember just being like, I can't wait to not have to suffer that much again. It's just like so, so hard. You go into these bike races and you just think, if I can just kill myself and die and suffer as much as possible, and maybe I could do okay. And eventually it just gets really hard to keep telling yourself that.
What followed was a series of hobbies and jobs, all leaning into her racing experience.
I had tried a couple of things. I did do some gravel racing, mountain biking. I did some coaching at Boulder Junior Cycling, where I'm from. It's got a huge junior program, and I really, really loved coaching them. And then I did some bike fitting. Just kind of dabbled in a few different things. At one point I had too many part-time jobs and I was exhausting myself because I'm just too, I think my brain is too busy to sit still. I think I just learned that I really love the sport, and maybe I knew that at some point, but I needed to remember it a bit. And it's okay to really love something, even if it's really hard and it's really cruel at times. I think sometimes it seems so cheesy and awful to be like, I love cycling, like I love riding my bike, I really love it. And it felt impossible to say that in the past, so I really got to remember that and embrace that a bit more.
Edwards was away from the cut and thrust of racing, but it seems cycling was never far away, even in her choice of holiday destinations.
End of 22, maybe around there, I kind of had like a little inkling, and then I went on holiday with my husband to Mallorca in March, and we were like doing some climbs, and I was like feeling quite good. I wanted to go for some QOMs and just like looking at the leaderboard and then having these thoughts, and he was like, you're crazy, you're not going back. And I was like, oh, I'm just, you know. And then we were watching the Spring Classics. I thought, maybe, I don't know, like, do I want to be there? I'm like, I don't know. And he's like, you're crazy. And then I brought it up another few months later, and he's like, okay, you know what? If you really want to talk about this, then we need to talk about this. for sure. There were a few people, my dad maybe, he was like, you told me you were never going to race again. I was like, yeah, I know. I did tell a few people that maybe you should shoot me if I try and return to the sport, because I was like, no, it's never happening. I'm never coming back. No way, no way. So that was a concern, and it was also a little bit of a concern in my own head. But I also just thought, well, worst case is I go back, I remember that the reasons I left, and then I just leave again. Like, it's not, I don't have to stay. I don't owe it to anybody to explain myself if that's what happens. So, but if I don't try, then am I going to sit here and wonder about if I had done it? When I started talking to Human Powered Health, they were so extremely excited that I was considering this that it made it a lot easier to make that decision as well.
In January, Edward signed on for Human Powered Health at the Tour Down Under. The comeback was on.
In the spring, I'd seen that I can be competitive in the field, particularly earlier in the spring. And then I had just a few crashes and illnesses and wasn't really feeling my best. So my last race in Europe, I actually pulled out. It was at Liège, and I lasted half an hour or something before I needed to stop the race, and I flew back home. The sport is brutal. It's really, really hard. And sometimes it is like, what are you doing? You just feel like you're hitting your head against a brick wall. And I really wanted to do it, but yeah, it is hard. And I did know in the spring that a lot of it was because of the circumstance that I was in. It wasn't just that I had it. It's not like I'd been training 100% perfectly and I was still doing so badly.
Racing is still a hard sport, but the time away gave Edwards the chance to reevaluate her old approach.
In 2021, I was really restrictive with a lot of things. I was restrictive with my food and my social life, and I was just a super anxious person because of it, because it turns out if you're hungry all the time, hanger is a thing for a reason. And I think that there's this mentality in cycling that to be successful, it has to be so hard, and you have to be this like hardcore, strict athlete that doesn't enjoy life. And it's just kind of like this mentality that I've been really wanting to challenge. So I think I told a few of my friends, like, if you ever see me, it's not to be restrictive with my food, or if anything gets weird or I stop communicating, like, please reach out to me and I need to reevaluate. But for a while, I didn't know if it was possible, because it's such a hard thing in your head to like break these beliefs that you have for so long and what people tell you about the sport. But I've been training so hard at home. I've just been having such a good time, and I eat more than I've ever eaten before, honestly. And but also, yeah, enjoy a beer with my husband, you know, once or twice a week. Like, it's not that big of a deal. I did that for the last 3 weeks and one Tour and Ladies Tour afterwards. So it's kind of these little rules that I set for myself to really enjoy it, so that I don't get to the point where I end up hating my bike again.
So far, so good then. A victory and continued enthusiasm. Van der Breggen, I hope you're taking note.
It's not that I expected to win at all, or even maybe hoped that I could, but I just wanted to see how good I could be, which in the end, it meant that I could win. So it's pretty cool. And I think in the sport right now, you need more than just good legs. And I had a good combination of things going my way. And the win is super great cherry on top. And I love to be able to say that I did win it, but I think that after the last 2 months at home, and then how I just felt racing really strong in the peloton last week, that I would have felt the same. Yeah, excited for the rest of the stage racing season. This is my first time racing the Tour when it's, you know, a full stage race for us, not just a few days, so that's pretty exciting.
Well, it was quite incredible news, Denny, wasn't it, when we heard that Anna van der Breggen was returning to the peloton? Quite infuriating news, having just recorded the podcast just hours before. But yeah, I mean, you know, when do you ever get that? A huge star like that returning to kind of, well, hopefully pick up where she left off. We'll have to see, won't we?
Yeah, I mean, we were saying last episode how excited we were about all the transfer buzz and activity going around the women's peloton, and this just took it to another level, really. I mean, Anna van der Breggen, of course, such an amazing rider in her heyday, only 34. When you think about Annemiek van Vleuten kind of going out at 41, you would think that Anna van der Breggen would know where she thinks she can be. You know, she works with the best riders in the world day to day. It's a really, really exciting prospect, I think, for women's cycling, and we were all wondering who was going to be the new rival to Damie Vollering next year. And in Anna van der Breggen, we could have that rival, with Damie Vollering, of course, moving to a different team. So that just injects another kind of element of spice into what we already think will be a really exciting season next year. And of course, you know, it made me think of kind of listening to Monica Greenwood and others in the previous episode, where, you know, she knew where she was. She was coaching some of the best riders in the world, of course. She felt she knew where her numbers were. So I'm sure Anna van der Breggen is in a kind of similar mindset. And I just can't think that any rider like that would be satisfied with the team role next year. So I'm really excited to see what happens. Of course, we also thought that Cassia Nevia-Doma might switch to SD Works. But in the meantime, we've heard the news that she's extended with Canyon SRAM. So she won't kind of trouble Anna van der Breggen in the GC or kind of team leadership roles either. So yeah, really, really excited.
Oh, but maybe Lotta Kopecky will. We don't know now. It's all still up in the air. But it's funny, isn't it? Because we really thought when Anna van der Breggen was retiring that she was almost passing the baton over to Demi Vollering. Hmm. It seemed that kind of way. And Joe, from your perspective, do you think, as a champion yourself, not that the Roffey Robbins thing is anything, I've totally overlooked that whole episode, Denny, I'm sorry, but yeah, as a champion yourself, would Anna van der Breggen ever come back? I mean, she said that she wanted to just kind of come and do her role in, for the team, but, you know, is that realistic, do you think, if you've got that mindset?
Really interesting question, because I think it's easy when you retire. I mean, at the point where she retired, she'd drawn on everything she could have won. She'd been world champion, road race, time trial. She'd won Flèche Wallonne pretty much every year. She'd ridden it. Like, it was just, you know, a phenomenal palmarès. And when she announced her retirement, I was like, I sort of get it. Mm. And it's amazing now how much the sport has changed since she's retired. I say the whole peloton has raised its game massively. We've got Tour de France, Sam Avec Swift. The Vuelta is now establishing itself as more of a grand tour in a different place on the calendar. So I can see the motivation to come back and want to win, 100%. I can also see the motivation to come back and have the lifestyle of being an athlete. Like, it's nice to feel fit and healthy. Like, it's, I mean, I miss training. Like, I used to get to ride my bike every day. That was my job. My number one thing on my to-do list each day was get up in the morning, go and ride my bike. Now it gets bumped right down that to-do list and often doesn't happen. So I think if you are in a position where you're like, I know I am physically good enough to earn a living from this, and actually I really enjoy riding my bike, I enjoy the process of training, and now there's all these new targets, I can totally see the motivation to come back. I get what she's saying in terms of not putting the pressure on herself in terms of coming back to do a job for the team, because actually that's a real privilege to be a professional athlete in any sport. You know, you're getting to ride your bike for a living, getting to travel the world, not being stuck in the team car when you've got, you know, beautiful yeah. weather and beautiful scenery around Italy. I'm sure she was sat there a few days thinking, I would have liked to have ridden up this mountain myself. I'm sure she'll be performing at a very high level. I don't know if she'll walk straight back in and start winning everything and be as dominant as she was, because I do think that the sport as a whole has raised its game. But as you were saying, like, she'll know what numbers people are doing. She's got that inside information, essentially. She's been completely embedded in the SD Works team, so nothing's going to be a surprise to her. I would assume she's been able to keep herself fit and still keep riding a bike. And at the end of the day, if she's enjoying that and wants to do it full time, why not come back into the sport? And also at a time where we're getting so much more TV coverage than ever before. Demi Vollering has recently signed that deal with Nike, so a huge, like, global sports brand are investing in women's cycling. Like, it feels like this would be a mad time for a rider that could be performing at that level to walk away from it. And obviously she did retire when she did. Fine, fair play. So yeah, why not come back if she thinks she can?
Joe Rousell says she did it for the money.
do you think I'm getting ahead of myself thinking she might be a kind of a rival to Damie Vollering next year?
I would love to see that. I would love for the, whenever I watch cycling, whenever I watch sport on TV, like, you want it to be fair and you want the best person to win, but also at the same time I want it to be an exciting event or an exciting race. I want it to be close. Like, when you get one rider winning by a lot and it becoming predictable, it almost becomes slightly difficult to sell it to new viewers, maybe.
Yeah,
if I'm sort of wording that correctly.
You want the great rivalry.
Yeah,
that's what you want.
Exactly what we had in the Giro, coming down to 1 second at the end. Like, for the good of the sport in terms of more eyes being on it, more fans, that's exactly what I want to see. So I would love to see van der Breggen challenge Vollering. I'd love to see them head-to-head at Tour de France Man with X-Swift next year on different teams, and I would just love to see how that all unfolds, and whoever wins, great, it doesn't matter, but to have that battle is exactly what I want to see.
It's a really exciting prospect though, Denny, isn't it? And it does fill that gap that we were saying that SD Works have in their kind of roster, because they had put Lotta Kopecky on a bigger contract and Lorena Wiebes, so it's kind of like that sort of classics and sprints is kind of filled, but they don't have that. I mean, Niamh Fisher-Black was also, we were touting her as a GC contender, but we haven't quite seen her have that edge. Obviously she won a stage at the Giro, didn't she? But you know, that it's just different. She doesn't quite have the sort of endurance at this stage and that sort of stage race mindset yet to be their GC leader.
No, there's no obvious kind of replacement for Vollering in their squad at the moment, is there? I mean, as you say, Fisher-Black may have the potential to do that. Marlon Royce may have the potential to do that. And we've heard, of course, she's out of the Olympics now. She's been struggling with illness, diagnosed with post-infectious syndrome, which I'm not quite sure what that is. But anyway, she's had a difficult year. So, yeah, we weren't really sure where that was going to come from. You said just now, Rose, that it, you know, could Lotta Kopecky convert herself into a GC rider? I mean, arguably she already is, as you said. I mean, she obviously just comes second in the Giro. So that's another interesting kind of twist or prospect for next year, when once the Olympics are over. The Olympics always seems to skew riders' preparation and their approach to the road, doesn't it? Because, of course, their riders are focusing on the track as well. So, it's just a tremendously exciting prospect. And I know we spend half the podcast speculating wildly about what's going to happen in the future.
That's the fun of it, though, isn't it?
Yeah, Lionel
it's
will
the speculation.
Be so unhappy about all the speculation. But I'm sure Ola would say it as well, but it feels like women's cycling is in such an exciting place, where we can be in this place now where we're talking about rider changes and transfers and who's going to be rivaling who. And I think the Anna van der Breggen move, though, is just such a left field move.
No one expected that one, completely unknown, isn't it?
But
we don't know, maybe Demi Vollering kind of knew, and that's why she was
maybe
getting out, or you know, because there's been a bit of unease in the in the team all year, so maybe she knew that, you know, there wasn't really going to be space for two top GC leaders. And you know, Anna van der Breggen has won so much that, you know, you kind of have to give that kind of sense of, you know, she has that sense of prestige that you kind of have to let her be the leader if she's won anything. And she obviously hasn't even ridden the Tour de France Femme before. And that's going to be such a huge motivation, you think, to coming back, because, you know, it's a bit like Marianne Vos, isn't it, where only the races that she hasn't won are the ones that just didn't exist before. And like slowly every year, Marianne Vos wins another race. And it's like, oh, can you believe Marianne Vos has never won this race before? And it's like, well, it's only been happened three times or whatever. And she just manages to add them up. But we shouldn't keep, you know, looking so far ahead and talking about how exciting next year is, because obviously we've got the Olympics coming up. Actually, I think in our next episode, that's what we'll be covering. And then after that, the Tour de France Femme. Obviously, Denny's already in Tour de France fever with his mustard shirt. Can you get more yellow, Denny, do you think?
I can, but you might not be able to see it.
Oh, my God. How appealing. Joe, what are you doing for the Tour de France Femme? Do you have plans?
I'll be following the race as a fan, so I'm out working on the Olympic Games for 2.5 weeks. So Tour de France Femme starts the day after the Olympic Games finishes. So yeah, very much just enjoying following it as a fan and looking forward to seeing, you know, it's the biggest race on the calendar in terms of publicity. I remember for so many years we had La Course by Tour de France, which was normally just a one day during the men's race, they picked a stage. And when I was in sort of my early days of commentating, I commentated on that event a few times as a co-commentator. And even when La Course was on like a Tuesday morning, on a random, you know, on the second week of the Tour de France, it still was the event where I got by far the most social media interaction from fans that were watching women's cycling. Because everyone gets, that isn't even a cycling fan, what the Tour de France is. And the fact that it had that platform was good for the sport. It was such a shame. It was just often just this one day sort of token event. But now we've got this full week of racing. I'm just so excited that the peloton keep getting that showcase. I'm quite intrigued about the day when there's two stages on the same day in Rotterdam. I have done many stage races in my day where that was a thing. You'd have like a shorter road stage and a time trial, and hated it. I was like, why can we not just have the time trial or a shorter road stage? Why are we doing a double day? So that would be quite interesting. So we don't really see that in the World Tour much anymore. Like, no. I have done that before, but it's sort of become far less of a thing. But it's another way to sort of get another stage in there, get a time trial in there. I'm a fan of time trialing, so I quite like that. Then we've got a finish on Alpe d'Huez, so I'm very excited.
Yes, you can't get bigger than that, can you? Finish on.
Doesn't make you want to come out of retirement, Jo.
No. Yeah, that's not Alpe d'Huez. Maybe that shorter road stage in Rotterdam that's just the half day, like the 67K one.
Half a stage.
But no, I think it's going to be a brutal race, and no, it should be good.
Yeah, no, it's very, very exciting. Well, thank you both very much for joining me. Thank you, Denny, as always.
Thank you, and thanks for mentioning my Ruffy Robbins achievements. I thought they'd never make the light of day.
I know, now when people come up to you, they'll be like, you're the Ruffy Robbins guy, aren't you? Under 9's player of the tournament. That's what they're going to say. And thank you so much for joining us, Jo. It's been
thank
a pleasure
you.
To have you on.
Thank you so much.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.